Hello, and welcome to another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. Today's episode will again be guest hosted by Livewire co-founder and executive director, James Marlay. The guest is Paul Moore, founder and chief investment officer of PM Capital. Paul is one of the most experienced and highest performing global equities managers in this country. In this interview, Paul shares where he thinks we are in the current cycle, some of the new thematics he's been exploring for potential future investments, and why McDonald's could face some serious headwinds in the years ahead. There are some wonderful insights in here, so I hope you enjoy the show.
Paul, 30 years in the industry, you're going to have to cast your mind back a long way to answer this question. What was your first investment? What got you started?
First investment was back in university days, and it was actually an investment in Blue Metal Industries. I acquired it from a family member, so probably not a lot of work done on it, but it was like jumping in the pool, you know, getting started, and actually got lucky because it got taken out by Boral. So it was a positive experience. And then I actually rolled that into Carlton and United Brewers. Mm-hmm. And again, more an instinctive purchase. I don't think there was too much work on the financials or...
You were just doing some product testing through university, I imagine.
That probably was what, you know, kind of triggered it, yeah. Anyway, I got lucky with that one too, in that Elders IXL purchased it. Mm-hmm. So first two experiences were fortunate. But yeah, not a lot of work done on them.
I'll just wind it back a little bit. Your first few investments while you're at university, how did you get introduced to professional funds management?
I honestly don't know why I was interested in the stock market. Probably because I'm a saver. Yeah, my DNA is saving, not spending. So for some reason, I always wanted to get in the stock market. And to be honest, originally I thought I'd go via the stockbroking route, because back then there really weren't any fund managers around. And to be honest, I didn't know that there were fund managers around. And it was really only by accident, when you go through those university, we have the companies come in to interview people. And I just picked up a brochure, and it was a fund manager that ran international equity portfolios. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's what I want to do. So I went and knocked on their door. Was fortunate enough to get a job.
Who was that?
It was Bankers Trust.
Yep.
In the very early days. And early in that part of my career, I was given responsibility for a US equity fund. And that's really, really where it all started.
Mm. I was reading through your Twitter account a little earlier today, and I came across a tweet that was referencing the fact that right now the debate or the question is about where are we in the cycle. Mm-hmm. And you've been through a number of cycles, you've seen it, so I'll put that question to you. Talk me through how you're framing where we currently sit in the cycle, and maybe draw on some of the cycles that you've been through before.
Yeah, so there's two parts of it. There's the long-term secular, and then there's the short-term cyclical. So from a long-term secular point, the main, factor in the market that we're trying to point out is our belief that long-term interest rates have inflected. Back in 2016, was it, where you got negative rates? That to me was the last nail in the coffin in terms of the bull market in bonds, because when you get negative rates, the system doesn't work. So you know it's not going to last, or otherwise we're in serious trouble. So basically, you've had a 30-year period where, when I was at university, I mean, home loan rates were like 17-18%. And then a year or two ago, you could get a negative home loan rate in France. So, it's been dramatic change. But the interesting thing was, when you look at fundamentals and technicals, all the factors that cause that long bull market have come to an end and are starting to turn. Now, you won't see it for a while. I mean, you've seen a bit because the US bond has gone from 120 to 3 or whatever. But it's the really early stages. And my belief is we're now putting in the floor for inflation and for long-term interest rates. So that's going to mean a really different set of opportunities going forward. But that's the secular. This is going to happen. Interest rates took 30 years to go from one extreme to another. So they're not going to go ballistic in a short period of time. It will slowly build. Short term, we characterise it as we're now in the post-Trump era. The first innings was when he got elected, and we saw a positive, you know, reaction in the markets because he promised to deal with a lot of the issues that business were facing in terms of tax reform, financial reform, infrastructure spending. But most people didn't think he could do anything. The second innings is when he finally got tax reform through. I was like, hang on a minute, we are getting progress. Market reacted very positively. But then they started to slowly realise, okay, the economy is growing, interest rates have backed up. Ooh, what if they go too fast, too soon, choke off the economy? And so now we're in the third innings where people are debating where we are in the cycle. Is it late cycle and therefore we've got a recession coming? Or the reality is, and this is where we kind of believe, is that if interest rates get too far ahead, they'll dampen things down. But the reality is the underpinnings are still fine. So we're going to get a few more years of good economy, earnings growth, et cetera, and therefore, you know, good acceptable returns, you know, for markets. And the reason I say acceptable because past returns have been exceptional, but they've got to be a bit more subdued. So when I look at the market today, the thing that stands out is it's very consistent. If you look at anything that is typically seen late cycle, it's reacting the same way. So the Aussie dollar, China, if you notice the Chinese market's down about 20%. Housing stocks in the US, because people think, oh, high interest rates, it'll choke the housing recovery. Now again, we think that's wrong because the housing recovery is only about halfway back to where it previously was. So you've always got to have fits and starts, but we still think it's okay. So yeah, I think, you know, so the market is very much in that debate now. It's throwing up opportunities. There's some really interesting areas that have become very, very cheap. And yeah, we'll find out over the next 6 months if it settles down.
So we'll get into cheap opportunities in a second. What are the specifics? You said you need to look at a different opportunity set when it comes to investments to what people could invest in or benefit from while rates were coming down.
Yep.
What are the specifics of what you think you need to be investing in now?
Well, you need earnings growth. That's the dominant feature, or a specific reason for being re-rated. Whereas historically with rates coming down, everything got re-rated. So to flip the question around, you need to avoid certain areas. And so anything that benefited from lower interest rates, so property is the obvious. Infrastructure, because everyone thought great asset, and typically they are, so they leverage them up. Now they're being priced for very low coupons if rates go back up. I think people underestimate how much leverage is in the system. And you saw it with Macquarie Infrastructure Corp down 50% overnight because of a problem with one of their assets. We've mentioned the consumer previously in terms of they were perceived as defensive. The reality is they hadn't grown their earnings in 10 years. And when interest rates started going up, it exposed the lack of growth. And not surprisingly, you know, things like Kellogg, Kraft Heinz, Campbell's Soup, those sort of consumer names, you know, I think they retracted about 30 to 40% over a 12-month period. We think Ronald McDonald, McDonald's is vulnerable because it's a property business. Mm. If you actually think about it, it's not about selling burgers. It's about how much you can earn from the property you own. And they've actually been selling off their restaurants, really focusing on franchise fees because Wall Street values them most valuably, leveraging up their balance sheet. So we suspect that that whole restaurant franchise system has been coming over leveraged, and investors have forgotten that if they get into trouble, who's the backstop? McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's. So you want to avoid those areas. In terms of where you can take advantage of, we think anything where the earnings are underpinned, but they have the ability to grow from here, and the earnings power is being underrepresented at the moment. So a classic is domestic banks, not in Australia, because they've got totally separate issues, but Bank America, some of the European banks, Wells Fargo again, because all the issues they went through the GFC and they've been dealing with, they're now got their capital in order. They're now returning 100% of their retentions with the blessing of the Fed. And you're starting to enter a sweet spot in terms of the US economy and therefore their potential to grow their earnings. So the interesting thing is they're on about, if you adjust for their excess capital, they're on about 9 or 10 times earnings giving it 100% back. So that's an effective yield of 8, 9, 10%, which in a low rate environment is quite phenomenal.
And the market could wake up to that and see them re-rate.
They've woken up a bit because they have recovered, but because it's late cycle, they're now kind of, maybe the story might come to an end. But we believe that's provided another buying opportunity, because when you're getting that sort of payout ratio, now you don't see it all because it's buybacks, et cetera, but the reality is you're getting a 10% return as a shareholder. I don't need any capital appreciation. 10% returns are fine.
You're happy with that in that environment?
Absolutely happy. We still think housing is interesting. We've had a big investment in alternative investors, which is a classic in terms of, people often wonder, how do these anomalies come about? And one of the biggest reasons, I would argue, is it's process. We've become a very process-driven world. Tick the box, and as long as it ticks the box, it's okay. Mm. And what I mean by that, you think alternative fund managers, so we're talking KKR, Apollo, they're basically fund managers, my business. Fund managers should know them pretty well. Pretty easy to value, because if you can't understand your own business, I mean, you shouldn't be in the business in the first place. But the interesting thing is they were dramatically mispriced 2 or 3 years ago. You kind of ask yourself, well, why? And the primary reason is process. They invest, or they run their business via a trust structure. And that's actually the way you wanted to do it, because it avoids the extra layer of corporate tax. So for a shareholder, that's exactly what you want. But the way institutions are set up in the US is that their mandates don't allow them to own trust structures. So the process stops them from buying these businesses. So 2 or 3 years ago, they, on current earnings, they were about 3 or 4 times earnings, which is just phenomenal. And this is how crazy process has become, because of that arbitrage and the way the market was being valued, the owners of these businesses worked out, you know what? If we become a corporate structure allowing these guys to buy us, even though it reduces our net cash flow in our pocket, the valuation goes up because they can buy us.
Yeah.
So let's do it. KKR announced it 2 months ago, they're up 25%. Wow. So it's actually illogical from a pure, because they're paying more tax. So in theory, they're worth less, but they've gone up significantly because the institutions can now buy them. So
you talk, the process that you have talks about identifying anomalies and themes or baskets of ideas that are similar. Have you been doing any work on new ideas, maybe that aren't investments, but are the, you travel a lot, you look to go and see what's happening in one market and another. Is there anything new that you've been working on?
Yeah, there's definitely quite a bit on the plate at the moment in the very early stages, because most of our investments kind of got into the third quarter, is the way I'd describe it, towards the end of the year. Some of them come back a bit. So we still think we can make acceptable returns the next couple of years. But the reality is they were set and forget. Let's look for new opportunities. And so the last 6 months, as the market's trying to work out where it's going to go, things have started to open up. Now, the restaurants that I mentioned, that's a very recent, so we're doing a lot of work on that. We're still doing work on certain consumer stocks because in Europe, we think they're still overvalued. Mm-hmm.
These are potential avoid
shorts
or short ideas.
Avoid. On the long side, there's a combination, and they tend to be more stock specific. You've got things like Oracle, which is a tech stock that people question whether they can grow in the future. Mm-hmm. You've got eBay, potentially interesting. Dow DuPont, which is a big merger, and therefore the potential for it to be mispriced because it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
And it's late cycle potential issues. What else are we working on? There's quite a few names there, but they are they're in the early stages, and where we're kind of trying to work out what really matters. And then typically we'll follow that up with going overseas, if they're companies that we haven't visited before, meeting management, et cetera, and going through the typical process. So, mm-hmm.
You're able to take currency exposure. And from the latest report, I've noticed that you've got a decent exposure to the US dollar. Mm-hmm. It's been already moved a little bit, and people are saying it's causing a few issues around the markets.
Yep.
What's the thesis behind the US dollar, and how do you see it playing out?
Yeah, part of it, you've got to go back to where we were a few years ago when it was above parity. So our view was you want to be 100% offshore. The currency was overvalued, it's going to come down. Came down a lot, bounced, now it's kind of mid-range. So I think it's kind of, it's not cheap, but it's not expensive. So the reality is we're a little bit ambivalent as to whether we're offshore or onshore. Our bias is to stay offshore. Mm-hmm. We've got a bit of euro, we've got a bit of pound, a little bit of Aussie dollar. So the US dollar, I mean, the MSCI is 60%, not that we take any attention to that. So it's a little bit overweight relative to what most people expect. I think the thing that stands out at the moment, if you look at, say, the Aussie US dollar, which is the main exposure, interest differentials, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, is now in favour of the US. Mm-hmm. That's the first time in a long, long time that that's happened. So as we know, the Australian economy tends to be kind of muddling along, whereas the US economy is quite strong. Normally that would mean the Aussie dollar's going down consistently.
Yeah.
What's held it up is the fact that commodity prices have done well. My instincts tell me that that's probably peaking. And so if they start to peak and roll over a bit, and you've still got those interest differentials, there may be another leg down, not a significant leg down, but another move down in the Australian dollar.
Yeah.
So we're still happy to stay offshore, and then we'll reassess if it does move down. I think the US dollar can't go up too much because it acts as a suppressant.
Yeah.
And as you know, they've got this huge trade deficit that'll only make that worse. As I say, I think it's more interest rate driven short term. But even, I mean, Europe, people are very skeptical of, but there's lots of signs of growth there. So I don't think it would take too much in Europe for the euro to go back up again.
Yeah. Paul, we caught up a little while ago at an event, and a question was raised around risks with the rise of ETFs. And you said you thought that it was quite a significant risk, without wanting to go into the never-ending active versus passive debate. Could you talk specifically to what you think some of the risks coming out of the ETF sector is and why they concern you?
And it's more kind of a long-term, high-level type view, in that the one simple rule you can have in investing is wherever they have the biggest crowd is where you're going to get the worst returns from. And it's just like when we go looking for opportunities, you want to look where there's no one else looking. The biggest crowd of all has all been driven by lower rates. So it's the bond market and passive and ETFs. If you look over the last 10 years, don't quote me on the exact numbers, but it's something like $5 trillion of assets have gone into passive and ETF.
Yeah.
So it dominates the market, it dominates purchases. And so a really simple rule of thumb, if that's where the crowd is, that's probably going to be the worst outcome going forward. And if you think about the fact that interest rates have been coming down, that's kind of what's driven that, because everything benefits when interest rates are coming down. So you may as well just be invested. You don't have to be that particular. But when interest rates go up, you've got to be much more specific about where you invest. And therefore, the passive and ETF outcome won't be what I think people expect. Now, the reason I say it's a risk is, if you look at ETFs, to me, that's the ultimate in crowd sentiment investing, because people come up with a theme, and it's like everyone piles in, and if they want to get out, they pile out. So my suspicion is at some point in the future, because there's so much money locked up into these structures, you're going to have an event, and everyone wants to come out. Where's the liquidity going to come from? It's all sellers, no buyers. So that's just an instinct. I don't know when, I don't know how, I don't know if it's 2 years' time or 5 years' time, I just don't know.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, we just keep getting driven by, can we find a business that we think we're going to get an acceptable rate of return, and that's what we focus on.
Yep. 30 years in the market.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yep, 20 running your own business. Undoubtedly, you've taken a few scars along the way and learned a few things, and it's probably changed or influenced the way that you invest now. It's part of developing experience.
Yep.
talk me through something that's sort of shaped, you know, something that you look back and you go, I got taught a lesson there and I'm glad I learned it. It's made me a better investor today.
Yeah. I mean, investing is definitely not a straight line. Yep. You have your good years, you have your bad years. You know, sometimes people think you're a superstar. Sometimes they think you're a mug. But what that highlights is that the most important advice I'd ever give to anyone that was starting off on the investment wheel is that you've really got to back your own conviction, make your own decisions, because that's the lesson that's really stood out to me. And it's worked both ways in that, I've had, when you have an instinct about a certain risk reward, I've been talked out of investments that have gone on to go up multiple times. And likewise, I've had red flags in an investment and you don't react to them because of either, one, they've already come down a bit and you think, oh, I'll wait for a better time. You never get a better time. Yeah, having the conviction to back your thought process and acting quickly, that's probably the two big lessons. And even really early on in my career, and this is probably where it really got ingrained to me, because back in, I think it was 89, 90, there was an S&L crisis in the US. And that's where I made my first big investment that was successful, really backing my own conviction. And it was Wells Fargo and the bank stocks. And Wells Fargo was actually on the front page of Barron's as a short. Yeah, it was going out of business. And anyway, I actually made some significant investments in the financials. And as typically, when you get 100% right longer term, short term, you got no control. And the first couple of months, the fund was down and the market was up. And I remember walking into the office one morning, and the head of the investment division had left a piece of paper on my desk with a big circle around my fund highlighting the short-term underperformance. And I was only 2 years into my first job, so it was pretty nerve-wracking stuff. Fortunately, my DNA is a little bit stubborn and I do tend to make my own decisions, but the pressure was on and I'm glad I did, because over the next 5 years, that fund on the back of those financials was the best performing fund in the country. So I think that's where it really got ingrained. You've got to stand your ground, because every time you make a really good investment, you're going to get questioned and sometimes you get ridiculed. And I've seen that happen to us many, many times. Even post GFC, we said this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, but everyone was going to cash. So that's really important. The other important thing is you got to do the work properly. My biggest mistakes where I've suffered investment losses, with the benefit of hindsight, it was pretty obvious that you didn't do the work properly. You got 85% there. You got caught up in the positives. You forgot about the negatives or the red flags. You didn't pursue the red flags, and you got taught a really harsh lesson. So I guess that's the benefit of being around for 30 years. You've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, and hopefully we become a better investor over time. But I can't underestimate the importance of backing your own instincts, backing your own convictions. Obviously, you've got to do the work to be able to do that. But there's nothing worse than getting something right but not acting on it because you've been talked out of it by the crowd who are focusing very much on short-term issues.
Step away from investing. I know you're a passionate sports person. What are you doing to blow some steam off?
At the moment, not much, because I've done my rotator cuff, so I'm on the sidelines. But I like, I do go to the gym whenever I can. Bit of boxing, golf, love kicking the footy. Yep. Watching the footy, AFL tragic. So unfortunately in the business, you don't get to spend as much time doing those sort of things as you'd like. But that's really the way I kind of get away from the intensity of the markets. Taking the dogs for a walk, to be honest, that to me is the best stress release.
And final question, 30 years in the industry, 20 at PM Capital, you're still passionate, hungry, see yourself doing it for years to come?
I hope so. We'll see what happens. I think Buffett and Munger are in their 90s, so
right.
Means I've got another 30 years ahead of me, so it's only halfway.
You're giving away your age.
Only halfway, unfortunately. The beauty about the stock picking side of it, I mean, you can do it until you drop dead.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, at PM Capital, we've got a team of fund managers and analysts that are coming along, and you know, we'll gradually pass the baton across to them. Yeah, as I say, it's one of those vocations that you can do until you drop dead.
Great. Well, thanks for coming in. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, and always good to catch up.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for another episode. I hope you enjoyed the show. While we've been on a break from our usual format, I've been madly planning out the next 6 months of the show. We've got some really exciting interviews lined up for you, so make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss out. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @LiveWireMarkets, visit our website, livewiremarkets.com, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And as always, thanks for listening.